This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Remember the housing bubble? When things started going bad, how much did you know? Was it news to you that big banks had been gambling billions on complex financial instruments? You probably realized real estate was a huge part of the economy, but if, like most of us, you'd heard almost nothing about what was happening beneath the surface. So, how much do you know about intellectual property? It makes sense that copyrights and patents are worth hundreds of billions to America's economy, but beyond that, most of us are in the dark. Two experts are here to help correct that. One's built an international company based on judging the value of patents. The other researches unintended consequences of government policy. They're not here to scare us, but they do say there are things going on beneath the surface of the world's patent economy that it's time for Americans to understand. First, the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. What are patents? If you get one for something you invent, how much is it really worth? How come major corporations have been spending hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars, to buy up huge collections of patents? When it comes to intellectual property and America's economy, is there something going on that could end up affecting all of us? Those are some of the questions we're going to be addressing this hour. And if you find you have questions or comments of your own, you are welcome to join in at 888-WMRA-TALK. Here with me, the founder and CEO of an international patent research firm based in Charlottesville, David Martin. And sitting next to him, a professor of business and finance at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, Mary Margaret Frank. Welcome to the Insight Studios.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Well, Dr. Martin, to you first. Why should anybody care about patents, and what role does intellectual property play in the U.S. economy?
Well, first and foremost, the public should care about patents because it's the only property right they have. And the reason I say that is because it's the only property right that all Americans have as a right granted by the Constitution. So we can talk about all the other property rights we'd like to talk about, but it's kind of nice to talk about one that we all have.
All right, let's start small then. Tell me what it is in the Constitution of the United States that you're referring to.
Well, in Article 1, the founders of the country actually realized that it was absolutely essential to build a framework whereby an agrarian and immigrant population could start incentivizing the exchange of ideas to create efficiencies, to create industries, to create the things that needed to be in place to build a country. Because remember, in the 1770s, when people were sitting around wondering about what they were going to be, up until then, they had been export-dependent, exporting their goods and services to the former colonial masters.
So Article 1, is it Section 8?
Section 8.
David, I'm guessing you can probably rattle this off verbatim.
You know, the tragedy is I probably can. And in this district, I'm sure Bob Goodlatte's supporters would love the fact that I can quote the Constitution because he likes doing that too. But
what does it say?
It says to promote the useful arts and sciences, inventors and authors for a limited time will receive rights associated with the control of the benefit for what they are willing to share.
And so it was because of that that shortly after the government was formed, the federal government set up a national patent office.
That's correct.
And this is where you go for both patents and copyrights?
No. The patents and trademarks are uniformly managed under the United States Patent and Trademark Office, or the USPTO. The copyrights are administered under the Library of Congress.
Okay, so we are going to get to the point where this intellectual property actually has billions of dollars of worth in our economy if you were to add it all up?
Yes and no.
Okay, so we'll get to your yes and no explanation after we get a little bit more understanding about just what patents and trademarks and copyrights are. So in the Constitution, we have this one property right,
correct,
you say, that is related to patents. And so I invent something.
Correct.
And I get a patent for it. What does that mean?
Well, a patent is a grant of what's called a distinguishable invention. And what a distinguishable invention is you as the person who comes up with an idea have to state that in comparison to the state of the art, You have moved the state of the art forward. In other words, Apple just applied for the patent for Siri's Double Ding. They want to get a patent on a chime that sounds like ding, ding.
You heard now, that on NPR this morning, didn't you?
Well, it was on NPR. It was on most of the major media.
Okay, but before we get that far into what's happened in all these years since the original idea of patents was enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, let's back up a little bit for a simpler explanation. So if in 1792 my great-great-great-great-grandfather invented a more effective way to plow fields, he could get a patent on that.
That's correct.
And I see the finger up, Mary Margaret. What does that mean?
Well, I think it's a little more complicated, and I don't want to delve into technical details. But I think the three words when I think about granting a patent that come to mind are, is it new, is it useful, and is it non-obvious? And you might ask, well, what? Those are the words that we think of when you have to have those three factors in place, supposedly, to get a patent. So when you go and apply for a patent, they don't just give it to you because you say you should get a patent.
Okay, but in this case, my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather really did, let's take it
okay, if you want to
invented a much improved plow.
Correct.
And that doesn't mean it was non-obvious.
Okay, so what I'm curious about is he's now gotten a patent.
Okay.
What does that mean? What does that establish?
So a patent allows you to restrict others from the use, the sale, and the trade of that improvement or that invention. It does not give your great-great-great-great-grandfather the right to make plows. It gives him the right to block others from making plows for a limited time without his explicit permission. But what's important to understand is your great-great-great-great-grandfather did not invent plowing. He did not invent the principle of a plow. He invented an improvement to the plow. So what he also has in this situation is he has an ability to engage with potentially the industrial plowmaker of his time to say, you've made plows. I have this improvement which will make plows better. And as a result, I now have an agency of engagement where part of the value of a patent is essentially a calling card that invites collaboration across industries, across scale. So that's really why the system...
Does it, in essence, give him licensing rights?
Sure. Okay. But to his improvement.
Please don't
not
be
to
sorry.
The technology.
You know that David will talk forever if you don't interrupt. So go right ahead.
No, I like that example. I have a really simple example that I have to admit I got from my father. My father is a patent attorney. And we were talking about this one night, and he gave me this example, and it was a aha for me. He said, so someone invents the pencil, just a plain old wood pencil. You have the right to block others from using the pencil. David, let's say that's my patent. David decides he's going to create a patent for the eraser. Now, David has a patent for the eraser. David can't put his eraser on my pencil. We have to collaborate.
Right.
We have to cross license together to be able to produce the pencil with the eraser.
Correct.
And so I think that's a really simplistic example of how it encourages us to work together, because otherwise ours is not as valuable separately, but together it's far more valuable.
Which is
so
why the production of the useful arts and sciences, what the Constitution actually framed, is actually a really good idea to promote the useful arts and sciences. So I want a pencil with an eraser. Whoever came up with the pencil didn't think about erasing things. Whoever came up with the eraser is too late to come up with the pencil with an eraser. So now I have to come together, and that's how industry is born. Industry is born through this collaborative vehicle called either licensing or acquisition or all kinds of things. So it's actually a very important utility.
We start in 1790.
Yes.
When the U.S. Patent Office first opened based on what was in the U.S. Constitution.
Correct.
And as you see it, it was a wonderful thing to have included in the Constitution because in so many ways
It encouraged innovation. It encouraged collaboration. It encouraged the building of whole industries. But at some point in time, things began to change, and you see a problem that got started.
Well, I would probably be a bit more Jeffersonian, and it's not because I live in Charlottesville. Jefferson called the patent system an affront to the free markets, a necessary evil. He actually thought it was repulsive and repugnant that we have a patent system, and I suspect I would agree with him, because his idea was that the freedom of movement of ideas should be unconstrained. He actually thought that it would be better if we actually just went to collaboration. But he agreed to the concession in the Constitution to say that given the post-monarchist movement, there was such an obsession with patent title. Because remember, a patent used to be, long time ago, a patent used to be the title of royalty. Even the term patent was. Letters of patent was your royal family. And so the term patent was offensive to those who were anti-monarchist. And the principle of enclosure of patent was also seemed to be an anti-monarchist advocacy. So what you have is a situation where he said it was a concession. The problem I have is actually with the Reagan administration, because it was in 1980, for the first time in the modern patent system history, where the Reagan administration confronted a reality that Japan was filing more patents than Americans. And rather than confronting the fundamental engineering deficits we had, we did something which Mary Margaret and I will disagree on. We actually incentivized the patent office to grant patents, so much so that when Q. Todd Dickinson was commissioner of the patents, over his doorway in his office was a banner that says, "Our mission is to grant our customers patents."
Okay, hey, David, I'm
when
not
the mission is to grant your customer a patent, the usefulness of the invention ceases to be the primary motivation, so much so that in congressional testimony, the commissioners of the patent office have said that they grant patents and let the courts figure out which ones are valuable.
Mary Margaret, it's been 4.5 years since the last time David Martin was here.
Yes.
But I recall his previous visits to this studio so vividly that I know we can get him off on a tangent on anything that'll fill up the entire hour. But so, I have promised the people listening that we're going to try and get to this point about how patents and the value of patents in our economy have a major hidden influence in what's going on in the U.S. economy and the world economy today. So I need to skip over some of the finer points. I hope to get back to some of them, but I want to make good on that promise to the people listening. Mm-hmm. If I can drag David a little bit further. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, David, one of the things I have to ask you is this thing that you're talking about in the Reagan administration. Was this the Stevenson-Wilder Act of 1980?
Yes.
And was the major impact of that you see that people no longer had to show a prototype of what they've invented? They just had to say, "I've invented something. I want a patent for
it." That was one of the biggest problems, because one of the biggest problems was you could merely submit something and have no standard that actually was the third standard that Mary Margaret just talked about, which is the reduction to practice. It had to be novel. Had to be non-obvious. It had to be reducible to practice.
So the
and
end
the
result
removal
of this change,
of the reducing to practice, which was wholesale removed.
But the end result of this change was that the U.S. was able to say we are innovating a tremendous amount.
Correct.
Look at all these patents we're granting, but there was no proof that
that's
those
exactly
innovations
right.
were actually going on. So that's one problem that relates to what it has gotten convoluted about patents in the U.S. economy
That's
today.
That's correct.
But there are other things that relate directly to how patents are being used for behind-the-scenes financing, at least behind-the-scenes
right.
compared to what most Americans know.
Correct.
So we're going to get to that, and we really are going to hear from the expertise of Mary Margaret Frank of the University of Virginia as well when we continue here on Virginia Insight. His father was an astrophysicist involved in research connected to the 1960s space race. So early in life, he lived in places as varied as Fargo, North Dakota, and San Diego, California. But while still in his teens, his parents moved to their Mennonite family's farm outside Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So his childhood experience included studying stars late at night and milking cows very early in the morning. We've heard he still starts his days very early every morning, but for quite different reasons. David Martin, founder of Charlottesville-based MCAM, is one of our guests. Well, she grew up in Winston-Salem with a father who was a patent attorney. In college, art history was her thing, and thinking she'd someday open a Southern folk art museum, taking an accounting course seemed like a good idea in order to be prepared for running such a business. Instead, she fell in love with the subject, eventually becoming especially fascinated with the unintended consequences of both tax and patent law. And those are the things that Mary Margaret Frank spends much of her time focusing on in her research work as a Darden School professor at the University of Virginia. Good reasons for both of them to be here to tell us about the hidden world of the patent economy. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So if we can skip forward, David Martin, how is it that patents have a stake, have an influence, have a part of the U.S. economy?
So patents and other intellectual property, including trademarks and copyrights, represent a significant part of the control of cash flows for our economy. They are the difference.
I don't understand that. How do you get to that?
They are the difference between a commodity price, which would be the price that people would pay if there's no restrictions on exchange of goods and services, versus a proprietary price, which is the premium that you pay to access something that someone has rights that they control. So very simply, I could buy and sell corn, a commodity, and it would go for whatever corn prices are. But if I have a patent on genetically modified corn seed, now I have an ability to charge a premium that is not just the commodity price of corn. And like that, with every other part of the world, I am going to get a premium above the commodity price based on the number of parts of the value proposition I can pull out of consumer dynamics at the commodity level. So if I have better corn, not just corn. I have a better phone, not just a phone. The better part, the part that makes it faster or more efficient or more utilizable, that premium product, if I can also control the pricing of that, is where the value of intellectual property sits. And as
Mary
a result,
Margaret,
the cash flows that that generates is where the economy gets its value.
Mary Margaret Frank, if I understand part of what David Martin from MCAN is talking about is that a patent can be seen as having a specific value, that a company can make an argument of, we have this patent, for the example David Martin was giving, for genetically modified corn, and that patent is worth so much money to us. I'm just going to pick a figure out of the air, $10 million. And there is a way, do I understand, that corn modifying company with its $10 million patent can then go to a banking institution and say, give me a loan and I'll use this patent as collateral?
Well, the institutions are going, if they're going to loan you money, they're going to want to know and do due diligence, at least they should, on the quality of the patent and
But this is much as if a company owned a skyscraper in New York City and went to a bank and said,
they're very different.
We own this property. Give us money and we'll use the building as collateral.
They're not the same thing? Because as David talked about, it's about cash flow rights. And it's about what kind of cash flow is going to be generated. Within reason, if you look at a building in New York, it's pretty easy, given data, to understand what the cash flows to that building might be, because you can go look at the building next to it and come up with an estimate of what those cash flows might be. So you can get a reasonable estimate of value on the building. Now let's go to the patent. By definition, the patent is supposed to be new and unique and non-obvious. So that means find a comparable to be able to value and get information about is much more difficult and much more uncertain. So the problem or the difference between a building and a piece of intellectual property is in its definition, new, non-obvious.
But there's a general principle here for someone as new to this as me.
Sure.
That seems to me similar. And I wouldn't be surprised if most of the people listening had never thought about the fact that there are corporations that own millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of patents that can use that as collateral to get money.
Correct. So an example.
Much as if they owned a building, they could use that as collateral to get money, even though, as Mary Beth pointed out, there are some differences. But I would never have thought before that there are billions of dollars of financing potentially going on in the U.S. economy that are based on these intangible things, patents.
Well, what you'll see is, I'll give you an example. The Ford Motor Company, in one of their more recent credit agreements, actually had an external valuation firm come in and say, what are all of the patents and the copyrights and the trademarks and all of the intangibles that we have worth? And the firm came back and said, let's call it $7 billion. Now, how they did their valuation, neither they nor Ford actually disclosed. So I can't comment on their methodology, but let's say for the sake of argument that they did a valuation where they measured the differential value that Ford and Ford Technologies creates in the marketplace. And let's say that that was $7 billion. To Mary Margaret's point, what's important to understand is that because intellectual property is supposed to be without comparable, that's the cool part about it. That's where the building and the IP story falls apart. Because it's supposed to be without compare, the immediate proxy, which says in GM's hands or in Fiat's hands or in Volkswagen's hands, would Ford IP generate intellectual property?
Okay.
Would Ford intellectual property generate the same value? And what the bank said in that case was, we don't think that we have high confidence in that. So what we will do is we will drop from the valuation that we were given significant discounts that says we believe it has some value, but in this particular case, we're only going to count about $2 billion of value, even though an expert has said we think it's probably $7 billion. Now, the reason for that discount is because the confidence, number one, that the property actually exists is not a sure thing. And number two, the confidence that the cash flows that those properties control are not a sure thing because maybe those cash flows in someone else's hands wouldn't be as valuable. So there are differences, and they're very important differences.
But still, Ford can borrow
$2 billion
against this intangible thing.
That's correct.
Called intellectual
That's
property.
That's correct.
And the idea being if they somehow can't make good on paying their loans back, then they lose the rights to that intellectual property.
That's correct. Right. And it's classic collateral, which at that point in time becomes part of what gets foreclosed on. If you're a bank, you get the foreclosure. Those assets go into a liquidation pathway, and they are divvied out to potentially one or many buyers who take pieces of it, much like in the recent case where Microsoft and Apple got together to buy the bankrupt estate of Nortel for $4.5 billion. That bankrupt estate had a bunch of patents in it, and the value of those patents to Microsoft and to Apple, to a consortium of buyers, was buying them so they didn't fall in someone else's hands. The value was not value based on what they wanted to achieve. It's based on what they didn't want somebody else to assert against them. And so the whole value there was actually purely defensive, where the decision was, I would rather have these patents in my control than let somebody else have them and then come against me to collect my cash flows.
So Mary Margaret Frank from the University of Virginia, are we now close to the point of getting people who've never thought about this before to understand that intellectual property, patents, trademarks, copyrights, can be having a huge behind-the-scenes effect on our economy, or are there some other factors we need to add in?
Well, I think patents do have, I think they're a foundational part of the economy. But just because you have a patent doesn't mean the economy is going to move forward. You have to commercialize the patent, and you have other factors that affect the patent. And so when we think about how patenting affects the economy, it's not a simple link. Nothing's really simple, but it's
but
not.
One of the things that it seems to me that we've established, based on what David Martin told us just a few minutes ago, is that there can be a securitization phenomenon going on. That's what you call it when you use some kind of property as collateral for loans, for financing. So we could be talking about billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of collateral being used for financing, where the collateral is this intangible, this intellectual property. And most of us, other than you and David and people in your field, have probably never thought about the fact that that's going on in the world of banking and financing.
Well, it goes on in multiple different ways. I just want to make sure everybody understands it's not unique. It is simply secured borrowing. It is just like your house. All of us do it. We borrow against our house, and that's secured borrowing. Companies are borrowing against their patent portfolio. That's secured borrowing. It's the same phenomenon. It's just using a different asset to secure the loan.
But there are other ways that you think, I think I've heard you say Mary Margaret Frank in the past, that the patent law has become especially convoluted and problematic in the U.S. economy.
I think what you will find is that it's become very complex as a system evolves. I think of the tax code very much like this. As a regulatory system evolves over time, it gets more complex. Events happen, and we have to deal with it and correct it and modify and add on. And as we move through time, by definition, the regulatory issues are going to become more complex. And along with that in the patent system, what we are using, think about this issue. You have a pencil. Patenting a pencil is a very simple device to patent. It's got a pencil and an eraser. The smartphone. It's got how many different gadgets in it that must be patented? And to think about that and how to move that forward, that's a much more complex invention or multiple inventions to pull together to create value. And so by definition, everything's gotten more complex, and therefore the system's gotten more complex. And as systems get more complex, they can create barriers, just like the tax system might create barriers to economic growth. Whether it's a patent system or a tax system, the more complicated we make it, the more it'll affect or could hinder growth.
And it's important to realize that if you are looking at, once again, your dashboard in your car, the smartphone you're carrying, one of the things that has evolved is that intellectual property generally, and patents specifically, have been very effective in actually slowing the rate of market decline rather than building new value. The smartphone is a beautiful example. As more patents go into a smartphone, the price of the smartphone comes down because you're actually not buying the phone anymore, you're buying the service package. So as I put more technology into the phone, I'm actually slowing the rate of market loss. I'm not necessarily increasing the value to the phone manufacturer, but I may be increasing the value to the telecommunications company. So now I might get my free phone with my 2-year contract, but the free phone is being paid for by the phone company who's selling the service contract. And their incentives may not be to pay you, the phone maker, more money because you put more features in your phone. So it's a very interesting proposition where the pencil, it was a pencil. Building a pencil is simple, using a pencil is simple, and controlling the pencil market is pretty simple. But when you live in a world where there are a lot of patents going into a significantly smaller and smaller set of products, the value of the patent becomes more distributed across more industries. So now the value of a cell phone patent really has as much value to Verizon or AT&T or Cricket or anybody else as it does to the handset manufacturer, which is the reason why understanding the complexity means I have to know all of the value participants, not just the pencil manufacturer.
And let me give you an example of that. I'm kind of you hear this a lot, this term a lot. I don't like the term, but patent troll. Okay. And what a patent.
A patent troll.
Yes.
A troll who lives under the bridge, has come out from the bridge, and is trolling around for patents.
Yeah. So I don't like the term, but that is a term, we'll use it because it's been popularized. And what they do is they go up and buy a bunch of patents and hope to then go and negotiate licensing agreements with large companies who are relying on technologies that they now own the patents for. So in relation to David's point, Apple and Microsoft may have bought Nortel's patent portfolio because the last thing they want is somebody who's not an operating company, a non-operating company, to come in and buy those patents and then come ask them for licensing agreements. So there's a whole world going on now because there are people searching for patents simply to go out and, I don't want to use the word extort, but I'll use it for shock value, to extort cash flow rights out of companies that are operating and making products. And so it forces Microsoft and other companies to take on a defensive posture in how they think about their patent portfolios.
The founder and chief executive officer of the international intellectual property rights firm MCAM, David Martin, is one of our guests. Sitting across from him, a scholar who spends much of her time researching the unintended consequences of such things as tax and patent law, from the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, Mary Margaret Frank. Mary Margaret, I'm going to try and come up with an example. You may be able, after I give this, come up with a more realistic one. But just in case this works, I've invented a new device for storing and holding your smartphone so that this holder is in a very comfortable place for you when you're not using it. And anytime you think about using it, it comes up to your face and is ready to use. So I get a patent on that. But this is my first patent. I'm trying to set up a company to sell this thing. How does patent law protect me or not protect me or influence the way in which this tremendous invention becomes part of the economy?
Well, it gives you the right to protect cash flows or exploit the patent. So if you had the infrastructure in place, you could go build a manufacturing facility and market the product and sell it.
But there's a problem if some company like Google or Apple comes out and starts selling this device
absolutely
without licensing it from me.
Absolutely.
The reason we're bringing up this example is that this is not as far-fetched as it seems.
That's correct. You would have to sue them.
So we're going to talk about that when we continue here on Virginia Insight with Mary Margaret Frank and David Martin. But we have to pause for a brief break. Darden School Professor of Business and Finance Mary Margaret Frank, along with David Martin, CEO of the Charlottesville-based firm MCAM, are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So we've got this imaginary invention that's just wonderful I created. What are the challenges here that have an influence on the economy and on innovation in America?
Well, to actually use that patent as a protection, to protect your right, you actually, if somebody comes out and manufactures your invention,
your magic holder,
you would have to sue to prevent them from continuing to operate. Well, as we all know, lawsuits cost a lot of money. And do you, as a small business, have enough money to pay for the lawsuit? So what you might do is challenge, this just begins to be courtroom dynamics to some degree, you challenge hoping there's a settlement. And a possible settlement would be a licensing agreement so that you can get cash flows. You would never actually produce it. You would let Google produce it, or Apple or Microsoft or somebody produce it. But you would get the licensing fees from the invention. But you've got to be proactive in sustaining your right to the invention to get any value from it.
And interestingly enough, that's where I think philosophically I'm back to my Jeffersonian alliance, because the idea was to support the innovator who's going to contribute to creating economic value. And Mary Margaret has done a masterful job of pointing out where the system has actually worked potentially to disincentivize the creativity. Because if I know as a small individual that my cost of building a business, hiring people, organizing production, and everything else is a barrier of a certain height, but above that barrier, I also have to go head-to-head with an Apple or a Google or a Siemens or an ABB, where they can just take it, and then I'm forced into some form of licensing agreement or otherwise. That's where I think Thomas Jefferson was prescient, because what he was saying when he said it was a compromise to free markets was that at a point in time, patents could be the new monarchist problem, where the only success is to the hyper-large, the hyper-wealthy, and the hyper-cash-advantaged. So we do have an inefficiency, and it is an inefficiency when the small inventor has to not only raise money to start a business, but a beautiful example is app developers for Apple. One of the biggest problems they face is that when they create an app, they are immediately enjoined from using or commercializing that app by a non-operating entity that has literally sent out thousands of letters enjoining people from developing applications.
That non-operating entity that you're talking about, that's related to the phenomenon of the patent trolls?
Well, that's where that terminology comes in, because it costs me very little.
I'm getting a little bit lost here. Take me through the baby steps.
It costs me very little. If I hold a patent but I'm not producing anything, to access the courts in Delaware and the Eastern District of Texas, where most of these things happen.
So these companies that Mary Margaret doesn't like the term, but are referred to as patent trolls, where they go out and just buy up whole bunches of patents.
Right.
And they never intend to use them to produce anything.
Correct.
They just use them so they can file lawsuits.
That's correct. And the cost of being a plaintiff when you have nothing to discover. Remember, a patent troll doesn't have specifications, doesn't have manufacturing documents, doesn't have R&D and engineering documents. Their cost of discovery is almost zero. Their cost to prosecute the case is almost zero, because all they have is a patent. The defendant, the little company that actually was making it, has every startup document, has every email, has every negotiation, has every document in its possession. So even to just get to discovery, many companies find that the cost to settle, which, by the way, every troll offers, is not based on the value of the technology. It's based on the cost of litigation. And so the offer to settle, mysteriously, comes in at about 80% of the average cost to litigate to the first federal case. And that is the reason why these things have become such high inefficiencies in the system, because the settlement is not based on the merits of the case. The settlement is based on the cost and distraction value of avoiding the case. And as that becomes more rampant, we have a bigger, bigger problem. And one of the biggest challenges we have is we don't have a good education system, and we don't have a means by which we educate professionals so that they can make more informed decisions. And one of the things that is what brings us together is the fact that Darden and Mary Margaret and Paul Simcoe and a few others, including the dean of the business school, came together several years ago and said it's time for business education to start teaching people about what questions to ask so that we can start building curriculum to help move people in a direction of being more informed advisors, more informed managers, and more informed consumers.
Mary Margaret, I know that one of David's really big things is about making education more exciting and more innovating, and he's probably not going to get any argument from anyone
including
against that whole idea. But do I understand in part that you think this aspect of how intellectual property, out of the view of most Americans, is influencing our economy, the degree to which patents are not being used the way that they were intended, the degree to which there is this interference with the patent trolls and all this hidden litigation being threatened and settlements going on, that that's a result of changes in patent law that have had the kind of unintended consequences that you study?
I think it's a result of many things. The law, I think that in the software industry, it's potentially a result of how fast the software industry is developing, right? You get a patent for 20 years, but the next new thing is developed in five. So the patent really doesn't matter. The 20-year patent life doesn't matter. So I think it's multiple contexts. I think globalization is affecting how we think about our patent system because as
So are there ways that, in addition to David's idea of people being better educated so that they're better protected from the phenomenon, are there ways that government regulation or how patents are given out could be changed that would have a positive effect?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. It's a very complicated question. And I think that one of the things that we need to think about is, are we allowing patents through to the best of our ability? We're never going to be perfect. We're never going to hit 100% or a home run on every patent. But to the best of our ability, are we providing the right incentives for the patent examiners? Are we getting the right patent examiners to investigate the patents? You need a very specific knowledge. The whole idea of non-obvious is it's non-obvious to an expert in your area. And so we need to make sure that we've put the infrastructure in place that we can do the best we can. I think that we are trying to do better at that. Did we have a period where we probably could have done better? Absolutely. And that, therefore, we have patents potentially in the system that the courts will have to decide if they're, the courts always decide whether they are valid or not. But we, one of the things that David has and I have talked about is many years ago, there was a fee structure. And I think Dave was alluding to this where you got paid, the patent office got paid based on how many patents they let through. Well, let's step back and think about that incentive. You're getting paid for how many patents you let through, not the quality of the patent. Well, that's a perverse incentive for a patent office. And so if we back away from that and focus on qualities, which I think we all care about, not number, then we'll have a better patent system.
To you on the other side of your radio, have you ever invested in the stock market? When you think about buying shares in a company, how much consideration have you been giving to the type of patents that that company does or does not own? After listening here for a bit, does it strike you that there may be a lot of laws governing intellectual property rights that could be affecting our economy? Your thoughts welcome at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. You can also reach us through Facebook at WMRA's Virginia Insight. And Carolyn did that. David, let me toss this comment from Carolyn towards you, where she says, the internet makes copyright protection almost impossible. Agree? Disagree?
Well, Carolyn is absolutely right, mostly for what is probably the least understood part of copyright law with respect to the economy. And that is copyright law with the internet has a problem. And that problem is a problem legally referred to as nexus. Nexus is just the location where data is stored and accessed. So as you look at copyright protection, and I just had a lovely conversation just yesterday in San Francisco with one of the top hip-hop DJs, because I'm in the hip-hop DJ scene so often.
You look like
but,
it.
But I had a conversation with a hip-hop DJ.
The bow tie helps.
Who said that their biggest competitor are file servers in Russia that are able to be accessed at nightclubs all over the world without having to pay any royalties. And the problem that he's facing is how to contain the problem of nexus. And nexus is just that intersection of where copyright data is or isn't stored. And the big problem, despite all of the FBI warnings you see on the front of all of your movies, the FBI warnings on all of your CDs, and I know I've just dated myself. My children are all rolling in their, you know, collective iTunes worlds right now. But all of those warnings notwithstanding, the ability for copyrights to be literally moved anywhere at any level at the speed of light makes the extraction of value for copyright exceptionally difficult. And so Carolyn is spot on with saying that the internet has made copyright a very challenging dynamic and one that we haven't figured out quite how to contain at the moment.
David, getting back to your comments about education, I have this quote here from September of 2007. Let me read it to you and see if you can guess who it came from. Quote, "We need to start stimulating at very young ages the notion of invention and creativity that we might have had in America 100 or 150 years ago, as opposed to a present focus on education for conformity," end quote.
That sounds dreadfully familiar.
sounds like a David Martin from 4.5 years ago.
It sounds like me with, actually, I had less hair then too, so no good there. No, and oddly enough, the education piece, which is so vital to all of us, is for consumers to understand that the decisions that they're making, the prices that they're paying for goods and services, are all affected at incremental levels that may not be recognizable. If I only pay 1 cent every time I access a voice-activated switchboard, I may not think about that until I realize how many times I'm accessing a voice-activated switchboard, and realizing that 1 cent of every one of those transactions is going to Ronald A. Katz, who lives a few doors down from the Playboy Mansion in Beverly Hills. If you're happy with that, then I would submit the system is working and your ignorance is great. But if you sit back and say, I wonder if a guy who has never made anything, who has never engineered anything, who has never done anything, should be getting paid for having duped the patent office into giving him patents, which when the patent office itself looks at goes, maybe we shouldn't have given these to him. If you're not so happy about that system, then the challenge is to inform yourself, to understand where it plays in your stock picks, where it plays in banking, where it plays in national policy, and then get active about understanding it, learning how to consume information around it, and being more assertive with respect to having your voice be part of public policy.
I would agree with David on multiple counts, but I think the way I would summarize it or phrase it is I think that one of the things that we have to understand, and for me, IP is a great example of
intellectual property.
Yes, intellectual property is a great place to understand that, is I'm not sure most of us understand the inherent risk in intellectual property. We just see it as it's a patent. There's so many inherent risks, and we need to challenge each other to really understand what those risks are. Just like with the credit default swaps, we didn't push ourselves to understand the underlying risk associated with that, and we ended up in a financial crisis. We, like in that situation, take that to intellectual property. We need to push, understand the risk that are involved when we make an investment. When you make a stock pick, understand what the company is doing. Push to understand what they're buying. Push to, if their big value proposition they claim is intellectual property, then you should be pushing to understand what types of intellectual property they have, because not every patent is a quality patent.
Amen. Is vital that as we move this conversation forward, and as we keep seeing headlines that continue to ratchet up valuations and the expectation of valuations, whether it's Google, Motorola at $12 billion, whether it's Apple, Microsoft, Nortel at $4.5 billion, as we move these headlines forward, we need a commensurate level of critique, which stands behind that headline and asks the tough questions. What did we get? What is the consequence to the consumer? Is the action moving, to quote the Constitution, the useful arts and sciences forward, or are we in a situation where we need to revisit those assumptions and build a more equitable framework to promote the arts and sciences and industry?
It's One of the things that I sort of have to laugh at is when somebody says the patent portfolio is worth $12.5 billion. There is a large standard deviation. There's a large amount of uncertainty. We state something, it's worth 12.5. We have no idea if it's worth 12.5. We are at best making a best guess as to how much it's worth. What would be more helpful for the consumer is it's worth between 2 million and 15 to 20 million. That's very informative. Knowing that it's 12.5, we need to know the range. The point doesn't give us much.
Have they given you something to think about? Our guests have been University of Virginia Darden School Business Professor Mary Margaret Frank, as well as David Martin, the founder and CEO of the international intellectual property assessment firm, MCAM. Thank you both for making time for us.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you very much.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. If you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about the work both of our guests are doing. And if you go to our Facebook page and click like, you get access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.